The Last Word on Today FM with Matt Cooper.
So much television to talk about with Jennifer Gannon and Joe O'Shea. Joe, I want to start with you. Can you detail for us, what did the BBC drop because of Prince Philip's death? And what did they do to compensate for that?
Well, they dropped a lot. They basically closed down or did dual broadcasting. They closed down BBC 4 on Friday night. They did. They ran wall-to-wall coverage of Prince Philip on BBC 1 and then mirrored it on BBC 2. They really disrupted their radio shows as well, the radio channels as well. They basically dedicated the entire BBC output for about 24 hours to the death of Prince Philip.
They and also, what did they give to people who didn't care about it? They didn't give there are plenty of British people who are not monarchists.
Yeah, of course. And also a lot of MasterChef fans who were bitterly disappointed about the final not being broadcast when it should have been. The BBC got so many complaints about how much saturation coverage they were doing about the death of Prince Philip. They set up a dedicated webpage where if you wanted to complain about it, you could go there and fill out your form and register your complaint. They acknowledged that a lot of people were complaining about it, and they set this webpage up because it seemed that the volume of complaints we're getting were in danger of actually crashing the regular complaint site, which never gets anything near the volume of complaints we're getting on that day and that evening especially.
Jennifer Gannon, this has a bang off it of a fear on the part of the BBC that if they didn't do this, there would be very loud voices, particularly in government, claiming that they weren't being patriotic enough, that this was another example of the BBC being anti-British. And why do they need the licence fee if they aren't going to be showing themselves to be proud to be British?
I think the BBC are probably damned if they do or damned if they don't in this climate. They're either being painted as, you know, too woke or too centrist. But I do believe that they actually had the opportunity to relax those old protocols by utilising their other channels, because surely to God, that's why you have a dedicated news channel. They have BBC, the BBC News channel. And I thought it was really ridiculous that not only was it BBC One that was affected, but BBC Two, and even, as Joe said, BBC Four. They should have at least been allowed to show their own content. If, you know, the BBC was to shut down the programming on one channel completely, then you'd have to have other channels, you know, to pick it up. I think at least shift MasterChef, you know, the final onto BBC Two, because so many people were anticipating, you know, the final of the show that they were following. And the knock-on effect to that was, thank God for Channel 4. Channel 4 had the right idea. They, you know, rather than go on this weird morning extravaganza that the BBC kind of had to do in a way, they had, you know, had an extended news show, and then they aired an obituary program before they went back to their scheduled peak time viewing, so everybody was able to watch the final of The Circle and then onto Gogglebox. And it worked, because Gogglebox was the most viewed show on Friday night. It had 4.2 million viewers, and, you know, that just shows the climate is there. Like, people didn't want to be stuck with this, especially in the age of, you know, you can stream in, like, the choice is endless. For the BBC to do this and shut down their whole suite of channels is a bit ridiculous, really. As I said, when they have a dedicated news channel there, that they could have pushed all this onto that instead. And isn't that what it's there for?
And Joe, what are they going to do when it comes to the funeral now on Saturday?
Well, yeah, I mean, again, they are damned if they do and damned if they don't. This is interesting, though, because, you know, they had anticipated, all the broadcasters had anticipated this death. You know, the guy was 99 years of age. It also was being seen by a lot of them as a dry run for what happens when the Queen passes away. You know, so it's... They're going to have to do blanket. I mean, if they covered the announcement of the news that he died in such detail, they're going to have to do blanket coverage around the funeral as well. But of course, they're also in a difficult time with COVID and restrictions, that the funeral is going to be necessarily tiny by royal death standards. There's not going to be a lot of people attending. They're also trying to, you know, stop crowds from gathering. So it's going to be a very strange one. It tipped over almost into North Korean state broadcasting, you know, at some stages. And they ran out of things to talk about very quickly, because the details of the man's life were well known. They had the same royal watchers that they always have on. They told the same anecdotes, and it just felt very strange for the whole evening.
Yeah, you mentioned about the North Korean thing. I mean, I don't know whether it was a hoax photograph or not. There was this photograph of the A2 motorway going into London. There's a road everyone who's gone in from Heathrow will be familiar with, where there's these giant screens on each side of the road at one stage where you go up high. And instead of the usual traffic information on them, there were two big pictures of Prince Philip on each side of the road, which is exactly the type of thing you'd expect in North Korea rather than in a modern 21st century. Well, I was going to say democracy, but it is a monarchy. Let's move on. Jennifer, the primetime set unveiled with much fanfare by RT last week has caught an awful lot of flack in the print media. Gene Kerrigan in the Sunday Independent yesterday dissing it big time. The Irish Times having a laugh at its expense. What did you make of it?
It's very busy. I just don't think it's the kind of set that you would associate with a current affairs show. It's definitely, it's not sobering. There's a lot going on. For me, I thought it looked like a Saturday morning kids TV show. Like, you'd half expect Sarah McInerney to be throwing it over to Cove the Line for a song on the way out to the break. The backdrop...
Oh, listen, when you're a guest editor, you might get them to do that, you know, because they have no guest editors. Like Luke O'Neill was the first guest editor.
It's all very strange. Like the backdrop with all the different rooms that you can see into, it looked like Funhouse, that game show from the 80s with Pat Sharp. And then there's this weird circular stage thing that looks like a Weebles roundabout or a stage for a game show. Like they have these really strange lecterns. I felt like Miriam was going to be grilling politicians about their favorite pizza toppings or how many Harry Potters they've read. Like it didn't feel like a current affairs show. It looked like something out of the Hunger Games or Tron. And somebody on Twitter said it looked like Barbie's Dream House. And I have to agree, it really did. The colors are just so jarring and it's very distracting. I'm not saying like current affairs shows have to be boring looking, but I was getting a headache before Stephen Donnelly even opened his mouth. And I know that's probably par for the course, but it actually was intense trying to look at it. It really was distracting.
Joe Shea, what did you make of it?
Yeah, Matt, like a couple of years ago, I think RT and Virgin, or TV3 as they were, put in these super high-tech studios which can do amazing stuff digitally, right? So it's like green screen. I mean,
yeah, we have one of these massive screens on the set for The Tonight Show as well.
Yeah, of
it's
course.
It's a question
yeah.
of what you put on the screen.
Exactly, because you could put dinosaurs roaming across there if you wanted to. You could put, you know, you could put...
No, Ivan Yates is gone.
Yeah. Right. Ooh. Okay. But you know, if you give producers, you know, these tools and these toys, there is always the danger that they will, as they've come up with on primetime, a sort of mad. Have you ever been in Charles de Gaulle Airport in Paris? That mad yes. futuristic tubes going everywhere and crazy vistas and rooms. It reminded me a lot of that. Crossed with a kind of a cocktail lounge or 10 or 15 cocktail lounges stacked variously around the place. Listen, you can see, congratulate them for trying something different, right? But it is, you might think it probably will be a bit toned down. It's just that when you give people these toys, especially in, you know, the era that we're in at the moment now, you know, they're going to try them. It's a box of tricks you give to somebody and they're going to try them. So they tried it. The response wasn't great. You may see it toned down, but, you know, at least fair juice for trying anyway.
OK, let's hear a clip of one of the most famous bits of political interviews that was on RT, but it actually came on the Nighthawks programme back in early 1992. The former Justice Minister, now deceased Sean Doherty, finally gave the story about phone tapping from a decade earlier, which brought down Taoiseach Charles Haughey.
You took the rap, at least people perceived that you took the rap for Charlie Haughey on the bugging thing. You bit the bullet and you were the one who was vilified. Now he is the man who is seen as the demon. Is this the time for you to re-emerge with your saintly robes on again?
Well, no, I'm not in the business of putting on a particular type of garb or apparel in order to suit interpretations here in Roscommon or elsewhere. No, the situation at that time was that I had a job to do. There was a decision taken in Cabinet that the prevention of the leaking of matters from Cabinet must be stopped. I, as Minister for Justice, had a direct responsibility for doing that. I did that. I do feel that I was let down by the fact that people knew what I was doing.
Did that betray any naivety in yourself that you thought that they'd stand by you when the time came?
I did believe that I had an obligation to fulfil, a constitutional obligation to establish who was taking information out of the most important boardroom in the country and making it available without authority to the national media.
Joe Shea, because you're of that era. I mean, that was the the story, which I suppose will Nighthawks will always be remembered for. But Nighthawks was way more than politics.
Yeah, I mean, and what a record for Shea Healey. Just two of the things he did was win the Eurovision and bring down a government. And finally, you know, see off Charles J. Hoy, or at least put in motion the train of events that brought that finally, the final scandal that brought him down. Yeah, he was, Nighthawks was amazing TV, and partly because Shea Healey was this mad kind of mix of Renaissance man and mad scientist, and he was a dreamer, and he tried many things. He had many different careers, and he made Nighthawks incredible TV, and I'm very much of that era, and I remember watching it and thinking that nothing has been done like this in Irish broadcasting before, and in a way nothing has been really done since. It was so loose, it was so freewheeling, the mix of guests was crazy. I mean, Tommy Tiernan kind of comes a bit close in his approach to doing things, but Nighthawks, as people remember, was like literally set in a bar or a diner, and there was drinking, there was smoking going on, and it was relaxed. And maybe that's what prompted Sean Doherty to kind of finally kind of, you know, and he may have had his own motivations, of course, as well, but to finally disclose what he did. So there's been a huge outpouring of love for Shea Healey. Everybody who lived in Dublin, you know, at that time, or had in the 80s or 90s into the noughties, has a Shea Healey story. And
yes,
he was really, if you know, I think if he was ahead of his time, if he was starting out today, he'd probably be some mad, you know, social media tech bro kind of guy, because he just, the ideas fizzed off the guy. Good ideas, bad ideas, crazy ideas, but he was never short of them.
And a Eurovision winner, as you said, as well, for Johnny Logan. Let's hear another clip from Nighthawks before we go to Jennifer. And this is in which Shea Healey talks to the very shy, usually, singer Enya.
Now, I have to say something. In all the reports I've read in the papers, it keeps saying over and over, a former member of Clannad or extra. Does that go up your nose, does it?
Sometimes. It's like, I wish now I could be looked upon as Enya as a person instead of always being asked about.
How long were you actually in Clannad?
I was with him for 2 years.
Yeah. And were you frustrated? Is that why you left?
Kid sister syndrome.
Really?
Yeah.
Nobody took you seriously?
No.
Now, you're taking yourself seriously. I mean, Enya, it's Etna, is that your original name? Yeah.
It's Enya. It's E-I-T-H-N-A, but it's Enya. Pronounced Enya in
down
Irish.
Down to Enya.
And not Enya, Enya.
But did you not do Enya for a little while? No, in the middle of it, no.
No, Enya would be some more Enya.
I see.
Ethnic.
Well, Enya. Now, does this Enya, having a stage name, does that allow you to be two people? Like, can you be Enya when you're out, and can you be little Ethan Lee Brennan when you're at home?
No, it's usually Enya all the time. There's no two people for me.
Yeah.
Okay, Jennifer Gannon, the background noise as well. I mean, that was the thing as well that made it so different to the sound-obsessed other programmes that you have, the clarity of sound for the viewer. This was like everything was going on, and then music, comedy, all sorts of things.
Yeah, I mean, it's really anarchic broadcasting, and I think it's the closest to something as like real that RTÉ have ever gotten, like just stick a microphone there and let the conversation flow. And I think Chris Evans did an interview a while ago saying that, you know, he was very influenced when he was on radio, when he had a break from BBC Radio 1, when he, you know, famously left, that he was really inspired by Jerry Ryan. But you can also see the influence, definite influence, direct influence from, you know, Nighthawks to TFI Friday, where he wanted to, you know, to let's do the show right here, that kind of spirit about it, and have it in a pub and have it centralised in that way that it makes the viewer feel that they're part of it too. And that was a huge influence, I think, as well. And we've never seen anything like that ever again, as Joe said, like just that mix of entertainment and current affairs. And I just think, you know, Shea Healey really just had his finger in most pop culture pies, whether it was, you know, the Eurovision or TV presenting or journalism. He was part of that mix of Irish society that he's ubiquitous and everybody knew who he was. And that's really something these days that's very special that you just won't get anymore, I don't think.
Okay, let's go to the picks of the week in case you run out of time. Jennifer, start with yours. This one that starts on Channel 4 this Thursday, also going to be on Amazon Prime. Frank of Ireland, and it has an all-star cast, but having seen the promo for it, I'm going, I wonder.
You wonder. I'm really interested in it. I think it's a really exciting prospect. I mean, it's starring Ireland's first family, the Gleesons. What's not to love? I'm sold already just with that. So it's written by Donal and Brian, and it stars Brian as the titular Frank, who's a failed musician and a really annoying man baby who has a giant chip on his shoulder. So he blames all his problems and misfortunes on everybody but himself. And Frank is newly single, surprise, surprise, and lives at home with his mother, Mary, who's played by Pam Boyd. And she, in her own acerbic, despairing way, is trying to get her son to face up to his responsibilities. And his ex-girlfriend Anya is played by Sarah Green, who is so brilliant in Normal People, and she has a new boyfriend, and this is pushing Frank over the edge, and he's dumping all his issues on his ever-patient best friend Doofus, who's played by Donal Gleeson, and he's a complete pushover whose full-time job is trying to look after Frank. So it's this surreal edge sitcom, and it's produced by the brilliant Sharon Horgan, and I just think it's got a really good pedigree to it. And not only does it feature, you know, Brendan Gleeson, dad Brendan Gleeson, but also it's got cameos from, you know, Pat Short and Tom Vaughan Lawler. And it looks really ridiculous, but really good fun. It has that over the top kind of frantic quality of something like, say, Black Books or Moon Boy. But it has that warmth to it that, you know, Irish sitcoms just have, that they do better than anybody else, like something like Derry Girls. So I'm actually looking forward to it. I'm optimistic that it will be one to watch.
Okay, I just wondered, the trailer didn't knock me out, but the trailer doesn't necessarily give you a good indication.
Don't judge it on the
depth that there
episode.
Might be for Sunday.
Yeah, don't judge it on the first episode. I always say that. Give something, like if it's a comedy, give it 2. If it's a drama, give it 3, and then bow out. So, you know, give it just the once over, I'd say. I think it's going to be good.
Okay, that's Frank of Ireland with the Gleesons, which is on Channel 4 on Thursday. Your pick is for tonight, Joe. Tell us about it.
Yeah, I was going to go with Frank of Ireland, but Jen got there first, so I had to go all serious. And on BBC One tonight at 9 p.m, it's Greta Thunberg, A Year to Change the World, right? This is a 3-part series starting tonight in BBC One at 9. And it does what it says on the tin. The cameras follow Greta Thunberg, who we all know at this stage seems to be controversial, even though you would wonder why, because her message is pretty important. The cameras follow her as she goes and meets world leaders, as she goes and talks to people, as she carries on her crusade, which started when she, I think, 14-year-old girl outside a little school in her native Sweden. I think it's going to be a fascinating look. It's, you know, the people are talking about Greta Thunberg in terms of a possible Nobel Prize winner, you know, which is mad again when you think of her, you know, the age that she is. So we've seen, everybody's got an opinion on her. We've seen them broadcast widely. I think it'd be fascinating to see the woman herself as she goes about trying to change the world.
Okay, we have a couple of minutes left to us before we go to our final item. Jen, I know this is the best news you've had so far this year, Love Island having a start date. But where are they going to have it?
Well, who knows? Listen, this announcement is the happiest I've been since pre-COVID times. So we're hoping that they're supposed to go back to Spain. But it was speculated that they would relocate closer to home if going abroad just proved too difficult. But, you know, ITV are keeping the details of the series under wraps, but it would seem they're heading back to Mallorca rather than Jersey, which was one idea that was floating around. Although at this stage, I wouldn't care if they rocked up to the Aran Islands, to be honest. I just want to see Love Island again. So also, I'm really loving the idea that this Love Island is the bastion of toxic straight culture, but it seems to be broadening their scope, and they might actually accept gender fluid contestants and bi applicants or members of the queer community this year, because there's ads for applications for this year's Love Island appearing on gay dating websites, and a Love Island rep has told the tabloid press that being straight isn't a requirement for this year, so just being single and over 18 are the only stipulations. So I think we're going to have the most diverse group of islanders this year, which is, I just think it's something that I'm really going to look forward to. And if the government want to keep us in even longer, I'm happy to do so once Love Island is on.
Gee, Joe, I think that would drive us out into the fresh air, into the streets during the summer, wouldn't it?
Listen,
it'll drive me somewhere. It'll drive me over the edge.
You'll be breaking into pubs.
Yeah. I'm buying a crowbar. I'm just amazed that they haven't had a more LGBT, you know, kind of element to the show, because you would have thought that would have been, you know, as a reflection of where we are and the dating and the relationships that we have, that it would have been like this all of the time. That actually shocked me when they were talking about, oh, for the first time ever, we're going to have, you know, gender fluid, LGBT, gay people, queer people. It's, you know, so it's just mad that they haven't done that so far.
I think Love Island was a really small, tacky dating show on ITV2, like back in 2017, 2016, when this new version of it arrived. So I don't think it had the spotlight on it that it's just become this cultural phenomenon year on year. And I think they just thought they'd get away with it just being this tiny, tacky show about straight people. And then because of the massive concentration of it and how much it's grown, it has to be inclusive now because, you know, 90%, like its audience has grown year on year. So they want to have it as inclusive as possible. And I really hope this also is about like body sizes as well. It'd be nice to see someone that was actually a normal size and not just size 6 in their bikinis. It would be nice.
Jennifer Gannon, Joe O'Shea, thank you very much.
The Last Word with Matt Cooper. Listen live on air from 4:30 weekdays on Today FM.